Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. In October 2022, I was invited to give a talk at one of the gatherings of probably the biggest white right group in South Africa. They had a gathering of their officers over a weekend. There were about 60 people there, and I gave one of two presentations that were given that afternoon. So this was a quick one-hour presentation that I gave. They did film it, but I never got a copy of the film footage. The leader of the group wanted me to give my viewpoints regarding what I'd written about wars. I had mentioned which wars I don't think are going to happen, which wars I think might happen, and the leader wanted me to prepare something around this article that I'd written. So I threw something together quickly. And this is the result. Since we don't have the film footage of the original, I've just used my presentation, my quickly gathered together presentation, and I've basically made a video with pretty much the same stuff as what I said there. When I gave that talk, due to a time limitation, I didn't get to the section on mega trends, but all of that is included in this particular video. We whites need to get our analysis skills into tip-top shape because it's going to be important for survival purposes in the future. So here is the very quick presentation that I threw together for them. Okay, let's get cracking. My strategic analysis. At the start of 2022, I saw Vladimir Putin the way that I'd seen him for many years. I regarded him as a Russian James Bond. And he created these kinds of images of himself as a tough, manly he-man. And he won a lot of supporters. I also used to enjoy this image of Putin. And Putin did a lot of good things for Russia. He improved Russia a lot, especially financially and economically. In 2006, Putin actually came to South Africa. This is a TV photo from my old African crisis where you can see Putin has signed some kind of agreement with President Mbeki there on the right-hand side. The Jews loved President Mbeki. Mbeki was a scumbag. Liberals and Jews love him to this day, but he was a scumbag and he worked very hard to help Mugabe destroy the whites of Zimbabwe. Here is Putin again next to Mbeki. Putin is no friend of the whites of South Africa. Here in February of this year, the Russians sent the blacks the message. Russia just reminded South Africa that it helped fight apartheid in celebrating 30 years of relations. And there's Putin, and guess who he's with? This is the black Jew, Ramaphosa. This Ramaphosa scumbag converted to Judaism. I'm absolutely convinced of this. This is my own analysis, and I'm absolutely sure he's converted to Judaism. Putin, by the way, did mention that when he grew up, he lived in an apartment and his family shared an apartment with some Jews. So Putin also has his Jewish links. And this year, The Russian government sent this message via Twitter. It says, President Putin sends greetings to African heads of state and government on Africa Day. Please accept my heartfelt greetings on your occasion of Africa Day, symbol of the victory of your continent's nations over colonialism. And there you can see Putin among all his African, black African buddies. And there's the big mouth Jew, black Jew to the right of him. That's Ramaphosa there on the right. So Putin gathered together, I think, something like 37 African heads of state in Russia a couple of years ago. The Russians were firmly behind the blacks in fighting for white destruction in South Africa, in Rhodesia, against the Portuguese, etc. But my view of Putin changed a lot when he invaded Ukraine. And as I watched Putin through the year, I saw him less and less as a James Bond, as a military type. I saw him more and more as a propagandist. And I now regard Vladimir Putin as nothing more than a propagandist, really. If you compare the Russians and the Ukrainians, you'll see that at the start of the year, the Russians had a military force, active personnel 900,000 versus Ukrainians 209,000. But in terms of reserves, people who aren't directly in the military but could be called up, Ukraine has got a large reserve that can be tapped into, 900,000. And then the Ukrainians and Russians look a lot more equal. In terms of military hardware, the Russians had more than twice as many artillery. Artillery is very important. Armored cars, not that important. Tanks, pretty important. Ukrainians were outnumbered 3-1 in tanks. Attack helicopters, the Russians had a huge edge, more than 10-1. And active Air Force planes, the Russians had a big edge, about 8-1. I personally have quite an interest in looking at military stuff, especially military statistics and military estimations of battle casualties, rates of advance, etc. These are things that I've taken a great interest in because I believe these things are very important for the future, for our survival, especially in South Africa. And what you see here is a photograph of training at a US Army War College, and they're busy playing a war game, and they're busy playing a hypothetical war. And these are the kinds of things that military people study all the time. The Germans also did these things. And they also have maneuvers and all kinds of things that they do. But I'm very interested in military, what you could call military modeling. And in the coming months, you're going to see some military models that I've been working on for race wars. Anyway, one of the things that I want to bring out is that in assessing military modeling and looking at warfare, there are three types of terrain that are excellent for defense. The first one is forests, the second one is mountains, and the third one, one that people don't really know about or realize, is cities. So when Putin invaded Ukraine, I was very fascinated by the Battle of Kiev. I was extremely fascinated by these huge armored columns of the Russians that were coming in to seize Kiev. And I followed it literally hour by hour in the first 3 days. I was very fascinated as to whether the Russians, with their armor and their heavy weapons, could seize Kiev. And I was certain from my military modeling background that the Russians might actually struggle to take Kiev. Everybody was saying, and Putin himself was saying, that he'd be in charge of Kiev in 72 hours or 48 or 72 hours. And it certainly looked like that. And even within the first day, the Russian troops were on the outskirts of Kiev. They had already reached the suburbs of Kiev by about the early part of the second day, I think it was. And so you had maps like this where you can see the Russians moving in on Kiev, and the Russians control these areas. And you can see other areas that the Russians had grabbed. This is by March the 1st. So they invaded, I think, in February the 22nd or so. And by March the 1st, it was looking like a done deal. But I was wondering if they really could pull this off, because there were 3 million people living in Kiev. And even if they didn't have much in the way of weapons, my military history interests made me think that I think they could actually stop the Russians. If they fought house by house, street by street, they could actually stop the Russians. And I was very fascinated by this possibility for a battle of Kiev. As you can see, a week later, there was another Russian pincer, and it looked like they were going to surround Kiev and seize it. And by March the 14th, the Russian pincers still had not closed, and it was starting to take a long time. March the 21st, Russian pincer is still battling to seize Kiev, and they get to parts of Kiev, but they can't surround it properly and they can't cut it off properly. And then we see by March the 28th, it's like things are not working out for the Russians. And there we can see by April the 7th, the Russians are gone. The Russians have given up, they've retreated. They didn't even really get into real fighting around Kiev. And it goes to show that it is very difficult to capture a big city. There are many reasons why the Russians lost. And the Russians didn't even really get into much house-to-house fighting. They just reached certain suburbs for short periods of time and were then chased out. It was a huge flop, and it was the first big disaster for Putin. So if you look by April the 21st, that's all over. Now the Ukrainians are starting to attack here around Kharkiv, which is the second biggest city. And then you can see by May the 7th, more fighting there, and they've managed to chase the Russians out of Kharkiv. May the 12th, and we see that as the months went by October 18th, the Russians had been chased out of all these blue areas, and Kharkiv was definitely no longer under Russian control. At this time that I'm making this video now in December, the Russians have also been chased out of Kherson. They've also retreated out of Kherson. So the Russians lost all the big cities, and they never even really fought house to house. When they were attacking Kiev, you saw lots of photographs like this one, where you had this 40-mile Russian military convoy near Kiev, and satellite images showed these huge convoys. And these convoys got stuck on these roads for weeks on end, actually. Well, they could have learned some lessons from the South African Defense Force in the time of white rule. In this photograph here, you are looking at vehicles known as Caspers, and these Caspers were South African military vehicles, and you can see they have got high wheel bases, and the South African military, in the time when the whites ruled South Africa, learned and believed in the importance of having off-road capabilities for their vehicles. And so it's amazing that these Russians, you'll find in all that footage from that time, the Russians are on roads, their tanks are on roads, they're stuck on roads, and they're getting killed on the roads. And they're not moving off the roads to go and fight, to go and fight in the fields and in the forests, etc. They could have learned from the whites of South Africa. The one weapon that came out of this that was a real game changer is the HIMARS rocket launcher system. This system has actually proven to be an incredible weapon. This is an American system. It moves at high speed, and its rockets can go long ranges. They can fire up to 50 miles, 80 kilometers. They move really fast, and this weapon alone is probably the key weapon that has enabled the Ukrainians to actually smash the Russians. This weapon is a true super weapon. But the white South Africans had also been there, and they, in their time, were actually the people who had the best artillery in its day. In the 1980s, what you're looking at is this thing. This is also from the South African Defense Force under White Rule. It's known as a G6. It had a range of 50 kilometers, and I believe the G6s now can fire shells over 67 kilometers. But back in the 80s, when this weapon could fire a shell 50 kilometers, there was no artillery system anywhere in the world that even came close to this. And by the way, the whites used these weapons against the Russians and the blacks in Angola. These G6s gave the Russians and blacks and Cubans a good beating in Angola in the 1980s. I think the designer of these guns was a Canadian who was later murdered. I think the Jews killed him at some point. So one of the topics that came up this year was that Putin threatened nuclear war many times, and even the idiot and asshole called Biden, piece of shit, waste of white skin, Biden the bag of crap, also was saying, no, Putin's not joking. Biden a traitor to his nation. The reason why I don't take nuclear war seriously, and I did do a video about this, but I'll quickly tell you, is because of things that I discovered that the Americans could do, that the CIA could do. And that is why I don't even worry about nuclear war at all anymore. I used to believe that America would be blown up in a nuclear war. It would be nuked to out of existence. Everyone would die. I believed in that junk. And then later on, around about 2011, I made some interesting discoveries that changed my view on nuclear war forever. The Americans used to have this plane called a U-2 spy plane. It could fly 70,000 feet. It could fly insanely high, and it flew so high that the Russians couldn't shoot it down. So they used to use these planes in the early days of the Cold War when the Russians were setting up all their nuclear weapons, etc. They used these planes and they flew them over Russia to go and spy on the Russians in order to watch what the Russians were doing with nuclear bombs and missiles, etc. But these U-2 spy planes fly slowly, though they fly very high. And one day, the Russians managed to shoot a U-2 down. And here's a news headline that says, Soviets downs American plane. U.S. says it was a weathercraft. Khrushchev sees summit below. And it's true, they shot down Gary Powers. I have seen videos and documentaries later that said that quite a number of Americans actually died in various flights over Russia. and that these things were top secret. But anyway, the real issue is, why don't I believe in nuclear attack on America? Why is it not a real threat? Well, enter Lockheed Skunk Works, the best of the most secretive aircraft developers in America. In the late 50s, they were already working with the CIA, working on coming up with a plane that was better than the U-2. They came up with a thing like this, the A-11, and this plane would be a spy plane that would fly very high and extremely fast. They went on at Area 51 to develop these planes. And this is probably one of the most secretive planes ever developed in American history. It's known as A-12, and the code name for it was Oxcart, and it was developed at Area 51. And Lockheed built these things for the CIA. And Oxcart later, the later version that followed on, was this plane, which is known in public, that led to this fabulous plane known as the SR-72 Blackbird. But the bottom line was that with these kinds of planes, the CIA was able to send these planes off to fly anywhere across Russia, anywhere across Russia at any time, and they would be over Russia and untouchable. They could outfly any missile. They could outfly any aircraft. They were too high to shoot down. Nothing could shoot these planes down. And the Americans used these planes to go anywhere and everywhere across Russia, photograph anything, see anything. And any time that they thought that the Russians were doing anything with nuclear weapons or rolling out missiles or anything, that have these planes right across that area, viewing it, photographing it, and giving feedback immediately. And the Americans were doing this back in the 1960s already. So there's no ways in hell that the Russians can launch nuclear missiles against America or any part of the world that America has an interest in without the Americans knowing it. The Americans will be onto it in an instant. So there is no chance of a surprise nuclear attack by the Russians. It's not possible. And when they need to bring out nuclear missiles, etc., the fact of the matter is that it requires a lot of work. There's a lot of information moving around, and there's a lot of orders moving around, and the Americans, when the Americans think there's something happening, they have these plans over them. But the original plans were Oxcart and then these plans, and now they've got satellites everywhere, etc. The chance of a surprise attack by the Russians onto America or Europe is just impossible. The SR-71 set world speed records, as you can see, flew long distances at great speeds, etc. Now, the other possible war that they cry about a lot in the mass media is that China is getting ready to invade Taiwan, and I don't take that seriously at all. If you look at the US Navy versus the Chinese Navy, they keep telling you, oh, the Chinese are a superpower, the Chinese are a superpower, they're going to crush America, they're going to conquer the world, we're all going to be speaking Chinese, etc. That's a lot of crap. And I've had a look at the Chinese for quite a long time. The Chinese, like the Russians, worked with the blacks. They were our enemies in southern Africa, and I don't trust them at all. Don't trust them as far as I could kick them. Anyway, if you look at the fleets, it looks relatively impressive. You'd say, oh, the Chinese have got 2 aircraft carriers. But then you'd see the Americans have got 11 aircraft carriers. And the other thing is, when you start seeing the actual weapons and their actual sizes and actual capabilities, a quick thing that'll show you that though on paper the Chinese Navy apparently is equal to that of the American Navy, the first giveaway is fleet tonnage. You look at the Chinese fleet tonnage, it's 1.8 million tons. The Americans are 4.6 million tons, more than twice that size. So that should already show you that the American ships are bigger, heavier, much more powerful. And these tiny little aircraft carriers of the Chinese, these are nothing. They can't touch these American aircraft carriers. American aircraft carriers are unmatched in the world. But anyway, so you have all these liberals and Jews and commies and all kinds of garbage telling you that China is going to invade Taiwan, etc. And you hear all this screeching and howling. And then they say, yeah, they're 1.2 million troops and they're just going to dash off to Taiwan. They're going to invade them and conquer them. Chinese are over a billion people. The Taiwanese are over 20 million. And the actual distance to Taiwan is around about 100 miles or so. But this is a much greater distance than from Britain to Europe, for example, like in World War II. And it's actually a whole lot more difficult than it looks. And I'll just show you a few reasons why I'm a total skeptic. So here is a more reasonable news article that said, how Taiwan could become China's Vietnam. And here is somebody who's looking at it much more closely, and then you start seeing that, you know what, it might seem like a good idea, but those dumb, useless Chinese, they're actually not going to be able to pull it off. So it says, on paper, China's military dwarfs that of Taiwan, but a closer look reveals how kill zone beaches, hostile terrain, and a 500,000-strong guerrilla army could inflict a Vietnam War-style humiliation on Beijing. So, the Taiwanese have got anti-ship missiles, they've got forests and mountains, remember, forests and mountains, nasty places to fight in, and they've got troops that'll fight endlessly in forests and mountains, and they've also got other weapons, they've got other sophisticated weapons, and don't think that the Chinese are just going to get to Taiwan without submarines and ships and aircraft having attacked them. It's not as easy as you think. An American, the Air Force Secretary, actually said something decent. He said, China would be making an enormous mistake to invade Taiwan. Damn right. The difference between a Chinese invasion of Taiwan and Putin's invasion of Ukraine is that the people most likely to die will be us, who will die laughing when we hear how many Chinese have been killed in the first few days. I assure you, if the Chinese load up those stupid ships of theirs and they try to move their personnel to Taiwan, you'll see how many will die. It'll be a real shocker, and people around the world will laugh themselves silly at these stupid, idiotic Chinese, whom the Jews have been pretending are a world power. No, they're not a world power. They're a bunch of assholes. The Americans themselves learned that doing amphibious operations is very, very difficult and very dangerous. And so here's a lesson from 1944, World War II, where the Americans were trying to take back the islands that the Japanese had captured. And the Americans actually adopted a policy that they would not invade the bigger islands. The islands that were heavily defended, they would rather leave the Japanese to starve to death, and they'd only tackle the smaller, easier islands. And when it came to invading Japan, the Americans prepared the weapons, the ships, etc., to invade Japan. But then the Americans realized that as bad as the Japanese situation was, that if they had to fight in Japan on the mainland, that the Japanese would kill about 3 million Americans. About 3 million Americans would die just trying to hold down Japan. And that is why the Americans just chose to drop those nuclear bombs to try and scare the Japanese into a surrender. And that's really what happened. Because the Americans themselves didn't have the stomach to actually fight on mainland Japan. And how good are the dumb Chinese at actually fighting a war? Well, the last war that they actually fought was in 1979 against the Vietnamese, who, by the way, are a bunch of communists as well, but the Vietnamese were buddies with the Russians. So in 1979, the Chinese tried to invade Vietnam. They did this invasion. They came in with large armies, and they didn't actually last long. If you go and you look at it, you'll find out that the war lasted 1 month. They advanced a short distance into Vietnam. But the Vietnamese were killing 1,000 Chinese every day. The Chinese were killing 1,000 Vietnamese every day. The other thing is that the Chinese said they came in with 200,000 troops, but I've heard bigger numbers than that, at least 300,000, and they came in with 400 to 550 tanks. But the Vietnamese who fought them had no tanks, and they were just between 70 and 100,000 soldiers and 150,000 irregulars and militia. And that little army of Vietnamese who didn't have tanks, didn't have any heavy stuff, they fought this force of the Chinese, and the Vietnamese say that it was 600,000 Chinese. I'd say it was at least 300,000. Anyway, the bottom line is that this little force of Vietnamese were killing 1,000 Chinese a day, even though the Chinese were killing about 1,000 of them a day. They only advanced a very short distance into Vietnam, and after a month, the Chinese gave up and the Chinese retreated. The Chinese have got other enemies as well, like the Indians. Indians and Chinese have had many border clashes. And this is from a video. You can actually find this video on YouTube. The Indians were laughing at it. The Chinese were sending off some troops to go to the border with India. And these singing Chinese soldiers, if you looked at them, they were actually crying. So they're on their way to go and fight the Indians, and they're busy crying. So they didn't look that impressive, hey? China's got lots and lots of problems. And there's another thing that is just destroying China. The younger people are giving up on life. They're sick and tired of working cheap wages for Jewish capitalists, and they're doing a thing called lying flat. And lying flat is basically doing as little work as possible. And this is actually becoming a huge threat to the Chinese state and the Chinese economy. And China's got other stupid things. The Chinese have got a property bubble. Their property bubble is the biggest bubble in the world. It's just a bunch of garbage. Basically, they've created a fake property market, and this fake property market, everyone's invested in it. They've got all these ghost cities, and they've been pushing money into this so-called property market, and the prices have gone up, as you can see, almost 700% in a period of about 17 years. But this bubble is going to burst. It has already started bursting. And you get all these ghost cities that are partially built cities. The buildings are not properly finished. Most of the things are not properly finished. And nobody lives there. Everybody has just invested in it and is just sitting there. And it's not used at all. So, as at August 15th, 2022, you can see that the China's real estate market has been falling. House prices have been falling for 11 straight months in a row. And it's an enormous, insane bubble. It is worth $60 trillion. So a $60 trillion housing bubble is busy collapsing. So I don't take nuclear war seriously, and I don't take the Chinese invasion of Taiwan seriously. I hope the Chinese invade Taiwan because everyone will laugh themselves silly and nobody will believe how useless the Chinese are. And then we'll all know that it was a total house of cards invented by Jews. There is one war that I do think is possible, and it threatens a part of Europe. Turkey has been very aggressive and has been fighting in a number of wars. They've been fighting in Syria against the Kurds. And this guy Erdogan, the leader of Turkey, he's very aggressive. And Erdogan has got a particular weapon up his sleeve that's actually worked out very well. He's standing next to a drone. This drone is actually created in Turkey. And it's a cheap drone, but it's actually a damn good drone. And they were selling these drones, and these drones could be used in many wars. They've already appeared in the Ukraine war. But one area where these drones really made their names was in a conflict in Asia, in an area called Nagorno-Karabakh. And these little cheap drones were blowing away tanks. And these drones are actually pretty good. They're very good value for money. And Erdogan is constantly threatening Greece. The Greeks and the Turks have had a number of wars, and there's a lot of hatred between them. And Turkey is big, and Turkey is bullying our Greek brothers and sisters. And they're really out to get, I think it is oil. I think there's some oil that's been found near some of these islands, Greek islands. And the Turks are making some threats in that regard. So I think the Turks are troublemakers and they might want to tackle the Greeks. And offhand, it looks like the Greeks are at a big disadvantage to the Turks. But I think the Greeks have got some good quality. For example, in terms of active duty personnel against the Turks, they've got 100,000 and the Turks have 355,000. So there they're outnumbered 3-1. But on tanks they're almost outnumbered 2-1. Frigates almost 2-1. Corvettes and patrol vessels, it's close. Submarines, the two sides are pretty equal. Fighter jets, relatively equal. But I think the Greeks have got good quality, and I think if the Turks try to bully them, that they're gonna have quite a hard time. But I do think that this Erdogan guy is a troublemaker, and I think that there could be something that'll come from this in the years ahead. We need to keep watching this one. Let's take a closer look at South Africa. I've been watching wars and problems close to South Africa, a war that I've taken great interest in. Is the black Muslims who are fighting the Mozambican government in the neighboring state of Mozambique. And white South African mercenaries have actually been fighting there. Can you believe that a handful of mercenaries, white mercenaries, using helicopters like this with machine guns, that these guys, small group of guys, mostly white guys with a couple of black guys, there are about 30 of them, and using a couple of these helicopters with some machine guns, they alone were defeating the black Muslims in northern Mozambique. Then, Then, because the whites were getting too effective at killing blacks, and apparently they were shooting some other blacks, and the blacks were bitching about it, then it was decided to get rid of these 30 white mercenaries. So they cut off their contract and they stopped fighting for the government. The Mozambican government's army could not fight these 1,000 or so black Muslims, and they brought in other countries, other African countries, including South Africa. So they brought in, and I think the French are responsible for bringing in the Rwandan army from further north in Africa. The Rwandan army did quite well at first. And then later the South African army and other armies got involved. Can you believe that they replaced the 30 white black mercenaries with about 3,000 troops, 1,500 from South Africa and 1,500 from elsewhere? And they replaced them with about 3,000 troops, and they are not able to do a fraction of what those 30 white and black guys did. And it seems to me that despite a little bit of fighting, that they have actually opted for starving the black Muslims out. That's what they've opted for. And that seems to be how that is going. But it's cost them billions, and it's taking them forever. They've been at it for a long time now. They're going to be at it for more than a year, and it doesn't look like it's going to be ending anytime soon. The biggest event in South Africa that is really important was the event that occurred in July 2021. This is the 8 days of unrest due to Zuma, when the blacks went totally crazy. And the blacks were attacking all these commercial properties and burning them down, etc. This is, for me, the most interesting thing that's happened, and it's the closest thing that we've had to a race war, and there are many very important lessons to learn from this. I actually want to do a whole video about the deeper part of this thing, but in this thing, there are a couple of things that we can look at. We had large numbers of blacks, possibly 15,000 blacks or more, that were unleashed and sent, especially in Natal, to go and destroy warehouses and properties and commercial properties. But this thing is the greatest black violence in the history of South Africa. And these blacks didn't set out to kill whites. And to my knowledge, not a single white person died in this. But interestingly enough, these blacks who went attacking these places, this is part of an internal struggle in the ruling party, the ANC. This is part of an internal struggle between former President Zuma and the black Jew Ramaphosa. And these blacks were told to target businesses. They went after businesses because Zuma's people knew that the black Jew Ramaphosa is supported by Jewry and the wealthy. So the blacks were told to attack the wealthy, and they also targeted the Indians because the Indians are also wealthy. Anyway, officially, 354 people died. 95% of those who died were actually blacks. They were the blacks who did these attacks, who were killed. The blacks were not armed with military weapons, but some were armed with machetes and some things, and there was some shooting. There was quite a lot of shooting. And they did arrest 5,500, but I'm sure many thousands got away. But where things really went wrong for these blacks was when they went into a suburb in the north of Durban called Phoenix, and they went off to kill Indians. Now, blacks have been killing Indians in the past, and in the 1960s they massacred the Indians in Zanzibar. But in 2021, something took place in Durban, which is unlike anything that's ever happened in Africa. When the blacks went into the suburb of Phoenix to kill the Indians actually shot back. And there were a lot of Indians, quite a lot of Indians, armed even with AK-47s. And so the blacks actually ended up with about 38 blacks killed, and the Indians even burnt down some of the black shanty towns. So it's actually an all-time first that the blacks have been killed by Indians. It's the first time ever in modern African history. Hundreds of years ago, Muslims did kill blacks, but in the last century, let's say, this is absolutely unprecedented that these geeky, nerdy Indians actually shot up the blacks. And the blacks were then the bunch of crybabies, and they screamed about the Phoenix massacre, etc., etc. So there's a hell of a lot that can be learned from this, and it actually shows many things that show that we whites are in good shape. The blacks didn't manage to kill a single white. The whites were functional during this mayhem. The whites were functional all during the mayhem. The police, the black police, were hiding in the police stations and for days didn't go out. Meanwhile, whites were moving around. Whites even went, I think whites even went to give ammunition to the black police. And whites were even fighting back and defending some of these properties of the wealthy. And I have seen film footage where whites held blacks out of a suburb. So actually, this thing proves that the black mass attack idea does not work so well at all. And we'll be revisiting this. So this was actually a wonderful thing that came out of South Africa that bodes very well for us in racial conflict. Make no mistake, the blacks did not specifically target the whites directly, but whites were still defending their suburbs and keeping blacks at bay. So I think that it bodes very well for the future. Let's take a quick look at some mega trends for the future. There are some other trends that show me that things are moving in certain directions and the future is going to be the end of liberalism. If you take a look at this chart, you can see the 2008 financial crisis and how much it affected cities. And you can see that the COVID-19 pandemic had even bigger impacts. So as far as I'm concerned, lots of these mega trends bode the end of liberalism. Another thing is that the alternative media is gaining ground versus the mainstream media. And of course, we've got guys like Elon Musk running Twitter. We've got Trump who's stirring up all across America. And Trump is doing all kinds of things. We've seen lots and lots of new social media and websites coming up, especially since COVID. We've seen the Canadian trucker protests. We've seen protests in Holland, in New Zealand, farmer protests. There are lots of signs that the Western world is becoming ever more unstable, and the liberal Jewish media and paradigm is losing ground. And even stock markets are in very dodgy shape. In South Africa, we've had record electricity outages and load shedding. Here is a headline from 2020 where it said, well, 2020 is the worst year on record for load shedding, that is rolling electricity blackouts. Well, step aside 2020, check out 2022. So have a look at this. The rolling blackouts resumed after they'd been here in 2015 and were fixed for a while. From 2018 onwards, you can see The rolling blackouts increasing. And you can see 2020, if 2020 was bad, 844 hours of load shedding, check out 2022. And these charts are not even for the full part of 2022. I've seen other charts since this that show that this number of 2022 is way out of the ballpark. Already it's out of the ballpark at this time. I'm telling you, it's an all-time record. As for Eskom, the electricity generator, this is the availability of electricity from 2013 to 2022. Take a look at this. Look at how it is dropping. It is dropping. So despite them spending tens of billions of rands, their electricity availability is just getting worse. This country is going downhill. South Africa is heading towards becoming a failed state. And a failed state is a state that is lawless, but there's good in it in that the state itself loses the ability to kill. So whites, we want to be in a failed state because the state itself loses the ability to kill. The only thing that offers any hope for us is secession. And I think that the breakup of South Africa is a very real possibility. And that is the path to freedom. Secession and breakup and a collapsed failed state, that is the path to white freedom in South Africa. And it's a topic we're going to revisit. It's very important. So let everything implode because we're going to survive and we're going to come out of this absolutely fine.
And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know, you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too, energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites.
Thank the whites, thank the whites, you know you don't.